Are you ready for the entertainment experience of a lifetime? Knockdown, Dragout, hard-hitting conversations, debates, and interviews. Well, if you said yes to any of these questions, sit back, relax, and enjoy something like no other. This is the Isolation Series Podcast, presented by the Scott Robles team at Douglas Elliman Real Estate, by WellbeingsPerformance.com for all your online meeting needs, by Barbarian Steakhouse, Canada's premier upscale restaurant. For more information, go to Barbarians.com. By ImprintPilates.com Toronto and the Greater Toronto Area's premier Pilates studio. And by the Toronto Immune and Digestive Health Institute. For more information, go to TIDHI.ca. Here now is your host, Spencer Miller.
Hey guys, and welcome to another edition of the Isolation Series. It's me, Spencer Miller. Very pleased to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Paul Shields. And Paul, it is Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. And let's jump right in. I want to get your thoughts first and foremost on the Toronto Maple Leafs. They are going into Game 3, the first home game of the series versus the Boston Bruins tonight. They looked overall pretty darn good from start to finish, in my opinion, on Monday in Game 2. And it was a timely goal by Austin Matthews that propelled them to the Game 2 victory. What did you take away from Game 2, if anything? And do you think that this will help them going into their first home game of this series tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of good things to take away from Game 2. I don't know that you can ask for much more from the Leafs. You know, they split on the road, and as frustrating as Game 1 was, I think that if you had asked any Leaf fan, any Maple Leaf player, coach, whatever, and said, hey, you're going to leave Boston with a 1-1 split, I think you take that every series all the time. So, I think that, you know, Matthews, that might have been Matthews' best game, best playoff game as a Maple Leaf. He was incredible. He was dominant. And like you said, he gets that goal that puts them over the top and gets the win. So you hope that they can take that confidence and they can keep getting better. Because I think if you look at the series, with the exception of the second period of Game 1, they've gotten better as the series has gone on. So you want that to continue in Game 3. You want the home crowd to be a lift. You want home ice to be an advantage. And we'll see if the Leafs can take advantage of that. And yeah, I think if they play the way they played in Game 2, there's going to be a lot of opportunity for that team to win this series.
Coming out of Game 2 on the Boston side, however, there was a lot of talk about Boston still sticking with their rotation of goaltenders that they did pretty much for the majority of the year, if not all the year, between Swayman and Allmark. And we know that Allmark is coming off a Vezina caliber season last year and everything like that. And Swayman has played out of his mind for the majority of this year as well. I understand when you're on rotation, you want to stick with it. You want to stick with what got you to the playoffs in the first place. But as we've talked about here on the program multiple times over the 3 years we've been doing this, playoffs in any of the four major sports is a different beast. So after Game 1 and Swayman playing the way that he did, were you surprised that they still stuck with the rotation? And what do you think they're going to do come tonight? Do you think Swayman is back in there? Do you think they give Allmark another opportunity to redeem himself? Or what happens on the Boston side?
I think they're going to rotate. They rotated all year last year and then changed it when they went to the playoffs and lost in 7 games. So I'm not surprised at the rotation. I'm not surprised they stuck to their plan, because the truth is that if the Bruins win the series and they have a good run in the playoffs, everyone's going to talk about the genius of the goaltender. Well, they split the goaltenders. They've got two great ones. They have this ability to do that, et cetera, et cetera. If they lose the series, and they split the goalies, then it's going to be, well, why did you split? Why didn't you keep one in over the other? You know, so you this is a great example of, as an NHL coach, you're getting roasted either way. Swayman was great in game one, but are we blaming the game two loss on Allmark? He made two or three exceptional saves. You know, the Leafs win by one goal. I thought the Leafs were the better team, and I don't think that having Swayman in there would have made a difference. So I understand the conversation around it. Of course, like, the microscope is highest and it's brightest, you know, when the playoffs come around. But I don't expect Boston to change their routine, because changing it last year arguably cost them that first round series.
Right. And sticking with the NHL playoffs from last night, what did you take away, if anything, from the the Avalanche and the Jets in game two? The Avalanche came back after a wild 7-6 loss in game one and ended up winning 5-2. So now it is tied 1-1 going back to Colorado. We know how good Colorado can be, and they showed that again last night. If you are a Winnipeg Jets fan and listening to the program today, what can you take away as far as positives go from a game two loss for the Winnipeg Jets fans?
I mean, you're playing a very good team, you know, 2 years removed from winning the Stanley Cup. The game one was wild. Certainly not what we see in playoff games often. I mean, there's always a few games every playoffs that gets a little off the rails. So if you're the Winnipeg Jets, you can't change anything. This is a good team. They had a really good year. They worked hard to get themselves in the position that they are in, and they've got one of the best goalies in the world, probably the Vezina winner this year. So you have to remember that Colorado is a good team, and that these two teams are not separated by a whole lot of points. There's not a whole lot of difference on the squads. Where one team might be better, like, you'd argue Winnipeg's better in goal. You know, I would argue Colorado's better on defense. Forwards are, there's probably a wash in the forwards. I think the big X factor is, of course, Nathan MacKinnon. So, you know, like, can you contain him? And then can your big guys, your Scheiflies and Toffolis and those types of players, excuse me, match the offensive output of MacKinnon and Rantanen and all the great players that the Colorado has? So I think that these teams are real close. I think this series is going to go long. And if you're the Jets, you just have to go into Colorado with the mindset of coming out with a split at an absolute minimum, right? Make that, do what they did to you at home, do it to them on the road.
Would you agree with a lot of the pundits saying that this New York Rangers team, even though they're playing a Capitals team that arguably should not be in the playoffs whatsoever, and they have a minus 38, I believe it is, goal differential or something crazy like that, do you think, however, that it is still possibly the best New York Rangers team that New York has seen since their run to the Cup with Marc Messier in 1994?
No, I think that's incredibly disrespectful to a bunch of those Henrik Lundqvist teams that were really good. Now this team scores more than those teams, but, like, let's not forget the Rangers have been back to the finals. They had one of the best goalies of all time. Like everybody, calm down, right? I think that when it comes to any President's Trophy winning team, they have to carry the weight of that, and they have to carry the weight of the being the best team, having the expectations. We've seen how hard that can be, and we've seen President's Trophy winning teams struggle in the playoffs. Now, I think New York is absolutely going to roll Washington. I think they're a great team, but there are tougher teams to come, much tougher teams to come in the Eastern Conference, right? If you get through Washington, you're going to have the pleasure of playing the Hurricanes or the Islanders. I think it's going to be the Hurricanes, but you're going to have the pleasure of playing a very hard and tough defensive team. And then your reward for that heading into an Eastern Conference final would be one of, you know, Toronto, Boston, Tampa, Florida. Take your pick on the Atlantic side of the bracket. It's not fun. The Eastern Conference is not a fun division. So I think there's a lot to be shown of the Rangers. There's still things about their game that I think are going to be challenging when they are playing teams that are more physical and more defensive. But you got to love the way they start. You got to love the fact that they're getting production from their lower lines in a big way. And I think the real test for New York is still to come.
Right. And on the Vancouver side of the bracket on the West Coast, their game two was nothing less to be desired, with Casey DeSmith in goal after Thatcher Demko injured himself at some point during game one and played through it for the remainder of the game. He has been ruled out for obviously last night's game and potentially the rest of the series from what we heard yesterday going into last night's contest. And Nashville rolled Vancouver 4-1. We know that goaltenders, more so in hockey, when you get hot in the playoffs, you can ride a goaltender. Just look at Cam Ward circa 2002 and 2006 for the Carolina Hurricanes. How much of an impact, however, do you believe for this Vancouver Canucks team, the loss potentially of Thatcher Demko for any period of time, is for the remainder of the season?
Oh, it's huge. Or,
remainder of the series, yes.
Yeah, I mean, if he's gone for the rest of the series, it's huge, right? Thatcher Demko, in my opinion, would be in the conversation with Hellebuck and Vasilevsky and Shesterkin and Sorokin. Like that top tier of goaltending in the league, I believe Thatcher Demko has put himself in that category, particularly with his play this year. He was excellent. And that's a huge loss. And that's no disrespect to Casey DeSmith. He had a good year in Vancouver. He was a solid backup goalie for them. But you're asking a lot of a goalie. And I think that, you know, Thatcher Demko is the great cover for any defensive deficiencies you might see in Vancouver. Now, I'm not saying Vancouver is a bad defensive team. But when you have a goalie like Demko, you are able to take more chances. You're a little more confident. Whether like subconsciously or consciously, you just, when you have a goalie of that stature, you are going to push the pace. You trust that goalie is going to bail you out if something goes sideways. And it's hard to make a switch like that. So I think Vancouver could do a lot of things to help protect DeSmith a little better in game three. And I think they'll obviously make those adjustments. I think Tockett's a really good coach for that. But I think a hard series against a really physical big team in Nashville just got a lot harder with Demko out.
Moving to tonight's schedule once again, a couple of game two contests of interest. First, in Dallas, the Golden Knights are leading the Dallas Stars 1-0. It was an interesting game one in terms of back and forth, in my opinion. Although Dallas did, Vegas did weather the storm of Dallas a couple of times in game one to ultimately get the victory. And then you have the LA Kings once again in Edmonton going for a game two where ultimately they really did not show up. Yes, they did get back into the game and make it closer. But overall, Edmonton almost played the perfect game one that they could have played. So I want to ask you first, what do you think is going to happen in Dallas tonight for game two? Do you believe Dallas ties it up, or do you believe that the veteran leadership that has returned miraculously for the Golden Knights and their Stanley Cup pedigree over the last few years will benefit them to go up 2-0?
I think Dallas will bounce back. I think Dallas is a really good team. I know that there is, you know, a lot of outrage around how the Golden Knights prepare their team for the playoffs, but I don't think it's going to be a walk. While they are the defending Stanley Cup champions, Dallas has been an excellent team throughout the whole season, and I think that they're ready to break through. I see this series going a long time, so I think, you know, one game does not a series make, and Dallas will be back into it. As far as Edmonton and LA goes, Edmonton, like you said, played about as perfect a game as they could. I think the way to really keep LA having to move the puck and having to engage is to score first and to see if you can get up too quickly. I think that Edmonton will get themselves in trouble when they if they get behind, right? So that's when the real challenge will come against LA. LA is a team that loves to lock it down. When they get one goal, they are not afraid to play ugly, ugly hockey. And if you're the Oilers, you want to force them out of that as much as possible. The Oilers are so dynamic with McDavid and Dreisaitl and Hyman and Nugent Hopkins and all of the players that have been tremendous for this team. This not only this year, but years previous. That is how they're going to keep this series out of LA's hands. If LA gets a lead, that's when it's going to be really, really tough. So I think the Oilers are going to roll through, but I think that LA... I don't know if LA wins tonight. I could see this series going 2-0 Edmonton, but I think LA will has the opportunity to you know, stem the tide. I don't see it happening. I see them getting their first win at home, but well, I guess, you know, like you say, Spence, time will tell.
Yeah, and I just want to ask you, because we talk about interesting narratives on the program from time to time, and over the last 48 hours, I've heard a lot of interesting narrative that bothers me tremendously from pundits in the U.S., especially on ESPN and TNT, respectively. They've said, does Connor McDavid need to win a cup in order to be considered the greatest of all time, or one of the greatest of all time? Obviously not the greatest of all time, but definitely on the Mount Rushmore. And to me, to be having this conversation is absolutely asinine, because it reminds me of the Utah Jazz back in the day, who, for all intents and purposes, if they did not run into the Michael Jordan teams that they did, they very easily could have won a couple of NBA championships led by John Stockton and Karl Malone. However, they did not do that because the Bulls were the Bulls at the time. But that, to me, does not take away from the fact that John Stockton and Karl Malone are two of the greatest of all time. Also, from a football perspective, nobody questions whether or not Dan Marino one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, and he never got a chance to, well, I mean, he got a chance to, but he never ended up winning a Super Bowl. So all that being said, I find it really disrespectful to somebody like Connor McDavid, who has put life into this game alongside Nathan MacKinnon and Austin Matthews over the last 7 or 8 years, as sort of the new wave after Crosby and Ovechkin did the same thing. I find it really disrespectful to be having that conversation right now, because no matter which way you slice it, the numbers say that Connor McDavid will go down, cup or otherwise, as one of the greatest players of all time.
Right, but I think you're talking about, there's two conversations here. One of the greatest of all time versus the greatest of all time. Right, so as good as Stockton and Malone are, they're not in the same league as Michael Jordan, and that's not a particularly hot take. Right, we could argue about whether it was the championships that separate them, but the championships are an easy metric to say, you know, this is his greatness, you know, propelled his team to this, right? And I think basketball is a great example of that. Basketball is a sport with which, you know, your star plays for 40 minutes of a 48-minute game. So it is, if you're Michael Jordan, if you're LeBron James, if you're anyone who else is in that one number one greatest of all time conversation, the impact you have on a game is, it can be very easily measured because you're on the floor so much for your team. I think football and hockey are very different. So I think I understand why the conversation happens, but in football, you know, even if you have a dominant offense, you're often not on the field for as much. You're forcing the other teams to, you're scoring points at a high level. Marino scored so many points. And of course they know how to manage the clock and everything, but you still only get to affect half of the game. If your defense lets you down as an offensive player, not a whole lot you can do about that. In the NHL, the very best players in the world play, you know, 20 to 25 minutes if you're a forward, you know, 25 to 35 minutes if you're a defenseman. So you only are directly impacting the game for a third to half of it. So I think, you know, I think the conversation needs to evolve. Right as of today, right now, Connor McDavid is the most evolved, the best player on the ice in any given night. He's amazing, right? I think to get him into the conversation along with the Gretzky's of the world and Lemieux and all of those guys, I think you have to get over the hump and eventually win a Stanley Cup. I think it's too early to say that. He's only, you know, there's very few of the superstars we're talking about won Stanley Cups in their first, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. It takes time for these players to understand what it takes to play playoff hockey. I think by the end of the day, Connor McDavid will have a Stanley Cup. So I think that he's in the conversation of greatest of all time. If he doesn't get one, then we can have a conversation after. And I would point to somebody like Joe Thornton. Joe Thornton is a great player. He is, you know, he's a top 10 scorer, I believe, in NHL history. He played for a billion years. The guy, his longevity is nearly unmatched. But I don't know about you, but I certainly wouldn't put him in the category of Gretzky, Howe, Lemieux, McDavid even. So if he had a Stanley Cup, does that change? I don't know. Maybe, but I understand why the conversation happens.
And just curious, speaking of longevity, just curious, where would you put Jaromir Jagr on the greatest of all time conversation? I mean, obviously he's not up there, in my opinion, with Gretzky and that. But he is one of the greatest of all time for his era and for his productivity at the later stages of his career, minus the last 4 or 5 years. And also special shout out goes to him because just a couple of days ago, he became the oldest player in the history of professional hockey, I believe it was, to score a goal at almost the age of 53. Now, I understand that it is also the team that he partially owns, so it's a little skewed there, but still, to be doing it at 53 on any level in professional hockey, that's impressive in its own right.
Yeah, and doesn't just because he owns the team doesn't mean the other teams are falling over backwards to let him score, right? He has to play the other team. I think that Jagr has to be in the conversation. He was an integral part in some of those Pittsburgh teams that won. He's the fourth all-time leading goal scorer in the NHL. He's got to be in the conversation. I think what hurts Jagr, and we've talked about it on this show before, is in, you know, what we'll call the end of his prime, he left to play in the KHL. And I think that hurts the conversation because if you look at all the other boxes, that he ticks them all. He's a top point getter. He was a producer in the playoffs. He has Stanley Cups. He played on great teams. He's led teams. He's played his longevity. He played in the NHL for quite some time. So, I mean, I don't think it's not about hurting his legacy, but if we're talking about greatest of all time, there was a handful of years, important years, that he played in a different league that's, you know, not as good as the NHL.
Agreed. And it still goes back to the conversation then that we've had here on the program multiple times as well about Jagr. His hindsight is 2020, I understand. But you have to believe that, did he leave for 3 years or was it 4 years that he left?
Something like that, I don't remember. And it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's going to be Ovechkin anyway. Like, it doesn't matter, right? Jagr's great. He could have spent all the years in the NHL and he might have caught Gretzky. I doubt it, but maybe. But it doesn't matter. He's still going to be second to Ovechkin.
Yes. Okay. But you do believe the same way I do that if he did stay healthy during those years and decided to stay in the NHL and scored an average of, let's say, 30 to 35 goals, he would have caught Gretzky.
So much hypothetical, though, right? Like, it's so much to know. And so he could – would he have had a shot? Absolutely. Would we have been talking about him the way that we're talking about Ovechkin now? I believe yes, but it's impossible to say. And, you know, the only thing we have to go on is the Jagr that returned to the NHL. And it's fair to say he simply wasn't the same player. He had good years when he came back. I'm not saying that he was ineffective, but the drop-off was real, and we don't know what that would have looked like at the NHL level. We don't know if it would have come a little later if he had stayed doing NHL competition or if it had come a little sooner thanks to injury and fatigue and all of those things we know. So I think there's a lot to celebrate about Jagr. I don't think we have to guess on what would have happened should he have stayed in the NHL. We could celebrate lots, but it is something you have to mention if we're talking about, you know, greatest of all time type conversations.
Switching to the National Basketball Association playoffs for a moment or two, I want to get your thoughts on two unbelievably crazy finishes from Monday night. First, in the Philadelphia 76ers and New York Knicks game two, there was a lot of physicality in the last 2 minutes. Nick Nurse tried to call a timeout that was not recognized, and there was two or three fouls that should have been called on Tyrese Maxey. Not on Tyrese Maxey, that were committed on Tyrese Maxey from the New York Knicks, and then Philadelphia may have committed a couple of fouls underneath the basket against New York's players as well, so much so that the league came out afterwards and said that there should have been at least two or three calls to send Maxey to the line and whatnot. Ultimately, it led to a go-ahead late three for the New York Knicks to beat the 76ers 104-101 and take a 2-0 series lead going into game three tomorrow in Philadelphia. We know that Philadelphia's crowd is going to be hostile at the very least. My question to you, Paul, is even though it was an exciting finish and it was compelling to watch because they weren't blowing the whistles, do you think it is dumb for the league to come out after the fact and say, look, we do recognize that these calls should have been made but weren't, when the result of the game has already passed and you can't do anything about it because it doesn't help the team that came out on the losing end in the end?
No, I think that more leagues need to be accountable. And I think that we are too used to the idea of this perfection aura around officials, and we don't have to look far. Major League Baseball, they protect their umpires as if they never get things wrong, and they are becoming worse and worse with the advanced analytics and what we know about, and when the camera angles and the advances in technology, like, it's just not good. The NHL is another example where they just, all you ever hear about is how they have the best officials in the world. Never mind the fact that we have on, you know, audio, we have evidence of referees basically, quote unquote, looking for calls, right? That affects the integrity of your game. It is ridiculous. I would way, way rather have the NBA say, look, this didn't go the way we expected to. We would expect our officials to be at a higher standard to make these calls. This is how we train them. Like, show some accountability. We hold coaches, players, GMs, everybody accountable for what the results on the ice. And we're supposed to just trust that, you know, officials are going to be perfect. We know humans are humans. I understand that you can't go back and fix it. The game's done and over now. But if there's an accountability, then you strive to make sure that it doesn't happen again or it doesn't happen repeatedly, right? How many years in the NHL do we talk about a completely different set of rules as soon as the playoffs start? NBA basketball is very similar. It becomes a more physical game. But as long as there's consistency and accountability, then you can continue to improve these functions. You can continue to see referees say, and I would so much rather, I think back to the umpire that cost the pitcher the perfect game. I had no problem with saying, you know what, I screwed it up.
Annabelle Sanchez.
Yeah, the names, I don't really care. The point is, he was accountable for making the mistake. Instead of saying, well, I saw what I saw. You know, we saw an umpire the other day toss the Yankees manager for something a guy in the crowd said. And then afterwards, he's like, oh, no, it wasn't the guy in the crowd yelling at me 6 feet away. I heard something at the end of the dugout 20 feet away. No, you didn't. You're just trying to cover because you made a bad call. Instead of just saying, you know what, I thought he said it. I misunderstood. I'm going to do my best not to do that again. That's human. And I hate the lack of accountability in other sports. So I commend the NBA. I understand if I'm a 76ers fan today. I'm very frustrated, but you know, 76ers and the Raptors have a little bit of beef. So I'm not feeling too sorry for you. Sorry about that. You're enjoying your playoff run. Get away from me. So, but I love the accountability and I love the fact that they do things like the 2-minute report. I think it's the only way that leagues and officials and players and fans can move forward is if you have accountability.
I agree. Moving to the Western Conference side of things from Monday night, the Los Angeles Lakers came out like a team possessed for about 3.5 quarters, and Anthony Davis played one of his best games of his entire career for 3.5 quarters. They were up by 20 against the defending champion Denver Nuggets, and then the Denver Nuggets literally walked them down and got themselves back in the conversation, which ultimately led to Jamal Murray getting an isolated fadeaway buzzer-beating shot to win the game by a couple of points for Denver after a very, very tough beginning to his night. He ended up 9 of 24, which is the same that he shot in game one, but he scored 14 of his 20 points in that fourth quarter to close it out. What did you make of the game on both sides? Because again, it had to be one of the more entertaining doubleheaders I've seen in NBA playoff basketball in a long time. And also, what do you make of the Lakers really feeding Anthony Davis for 3.5 quarters? But then when it came to crunch time in the fourth, he only had one shot and went 0-for-1. That, to me, is shocking.
Yeah, I just think the Nuggets have found a way to, you know, to stifle the Lakers. This is 6 losses in a row. Did I read that right to the, but from the Lakers and the Nuggets? Like, that's rough, right? Like, that is, you know, it's hard to beat any professional sports team, even 2 games in a row. 3 games in a row can be challenging, right? When we see like 4 game sweeps in any playoff series or even in baseball, you know, usually because of the way the team's game plan and because of all the metrics we have, coaches are able to find an adjustment. Of course it happens. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's really hard. It's way harder than people think to beat a team 2 times in a row, never mind 6. So the Nuggets have unlocked something, and whatever the Lakers had in the first half of the game, they didn't have in the rest of it. So, I think the Nuggets are going to be pretty unstoppable. I just like the way that team's built, and I think that I think Jokic is just he's next level. Jamal Murray looks healthy again, which I think is going to be huge for that team, and that's just a really good squad. And I think the Lakers are a little bit of pretenders, if I'm being honest. I think that, you know, a lot of what they were able to get done this year was on the back of, you know, LeBron James, which is insane at his age and his stage in his career. He's been incredible. I just think the Lakers have run into, you know, a monster here that they're going to have a real hard time coming back in this series.
Would you agree with me, however, despite all of the accolades that LeBron James rightfully is getting at his age and for his career, that LeBron James is one of the biggest whiners in the NBA going today? Because I saw a statistic after the game on Monday night that was very shocking to me, because LeBron, in his post-game press conference, started it off by saying, "Why the bleep do we have replay if we're not going to use it?" referring to a call that didn't get called against one of his teammates at the end of the third quarter, which ultimately didn't affect the end of the game. We know this, but what makes me laugh about that, and I want to get your thoughts, is since LeBron James has been a Laker for the last however many years now he's been with the Lakers, there is about a 356 call differential between the next closest team getting foul calls compared to the Lakers. So I find it interesting that LeBron continues to whine and complain about these things. But we know that athletes do that in general, no matter who you are. I get it. But because of that huge disparity, he has nothing to complain about, in my opinion.
Yeah, but it works. Why would he stop? There's a long history of good NBA players who complain a lot and get the calls. It's a star-driven league. It's been a star-driven league for as long as I can remember. And I don't remember a single star being any different, if I'm being perfectly honest. The way in which they complain and how the attention that they get might be different, but this is gamesmanship. It makes no difference. To me, talking about calls that went your way or didn't go your way, it's all part of the game. I think that sure, there's times it can be excessive and there are players that can abuse that, but it works. So, why stop?
Okay. And we'll finish today's Wednesday edition of the Isolation Series. This way, the Toronto Blue Jays played their second game of four in Kansas City with Kevin Gausman on the mound last night. And once again, they came up short with Kevin Gausman on the mound this season. Now, Kevin Gausman didn't look bad for the majority of last night's game, in my opinion. But once again, this team, although they have won 7 of their last 10, they are inexplicably doing it without scoring that many runs. And again, with Gausman on the mound, a lot of the time we see him struggle to get run support. That's how it's been since he came to Toronto, even when he's going really, really well. And so the Blue Jays, I believe the final score was either 4-2 or 3-2 for Kansas City. Do you take anything away from yesterday's game? And more specifically, the fact that the Blue Jays, once again, as I said, even though they have won 7 out of their last 10 games, are doing it without scoring runs of consequence necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, are we surprised? This is the team. This is what we complained about all offseason. Where do the runs come from if they're not coming from, Laddie or Bo or, pick your guy at the top of the rotation or top of the order, right? They've played some good baseball. They're above 500. They have a chance to win another series. They didn't look great at the plate yesterday. I think this is going to be the conversation we have all year, because this is exactly what we wanted this team to address in the offseason, and they didn't really do it. So it's not surprising. I think their pitching is coming around nicely. I thought Gausman was good, actually, for much of the game, and the Jays need to find ways to manufacture runs because they're not getting any help personnel-wise.
Right. What do you think they need to do from a personnel perspective to sort of enhance this team moving forward? I know that we've talked multiple times on what they should have done to address stuff in the offseason, and they didn't. But if you are Ross Atkins right now, are you already actively looking to improve this team in one way, shape, or form?
Well, I mean, I've said hundreds of times on this show, if you're a GM and you're not doing that, you're not doing your job. But I don't know what Ross Atkins is doing. I don't know what he did in the playoff or in the offseason, excuse me. I literally have no idea. So I don't know the answer, because if they were actively looking for something, we would have a different looking lineup. Now, look, and I don't want to discredit, like, bringing Kevin Kiermaier back is a big deal. He played really well for the Jays last year, and he's playing well again. He's an elite center fielder. He brings some leadership and some personality and some pop to your team. So no problem. Turner's been very good, right? He came in and he's stepped into that Brandon Belt role from last year and done really well. But like, those were your big signings. So I have no idea what Ross Atkins is doing other than putting his feet on a desk and having a nap. So I don't know. I don't know what to do. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what's available to them. No team out there is going to help them. So that's why I say, like, this is going to be the conversation all year. There is no help coming. This team needs to figure it out.
Right. And how much longer do you think the Jays go without bringing up Ricky Tiedemann. We know that Ricky Tiedemann is one of their prized prospects and has been doing great things in Buffalo and everything like that. We also know that he is still really young. We've talked about that here on the program multiple times as well. But even from a bullpen perspective, do you think it is smart to bring him up and allow him to get his feet wet with the major league club out of the bullpen to replace somebody that is not necessarily that consistent? We know that Chad Green went down with an injury just a few days ago. We addressed that with Kyle on Monday, and they brought back Nate Pearson. And even though Nate Pearson has looked better this year and more consistent this year, he once again got lit up the other night. So would you look to bring up Ricky Tiedemann just to see if he could give you a spark out of the bullpen necessarily?
No. He's 21 years old. He's having elbow issues. I think that's bringing him to Toronto this week for somebody to have a look at his elbow. And your pitching has been fine. Pitching is not the reason this Blue Jays team is hovering around 500. There's no reason to bring him up any sooner than absolutely necessary. I would not consider this team to be a well-oiled machine at this moment. And when you have a 21-year-old pitcher with that much talent, let him pitch. Particularly if what you want him to be is a starter, bringing him up to put him in the bullpen, you know, for a team that's mediocre, makes zero sense to me. So I would let him bake. If you run into injuries that are affecting it, if your pitching is, you know, unusable, or there's pitchers at the back end of the rotation that aren't doing the job, then, you know, maybe that opens the door. But as far as I see it right now, the doors for him are closed, not permanently, but for now. Let him be good. Let him go and dominate. Let him pitch, you know, a million innings that where he can just absolutely dominate guys and get all the confidence and all the good habits and everything you want out of a young pitcher. 21 is insanely young, particularly for pitchers. We saw what happened with Alek Manoah. Now, I know they're two different people. I don't know either of them personally, so I have no idea if one can handle it better over the other. But we were all jumping out of our skin to make Alek Manoah the new ace of the Toronto Blue Jays, and now he can barely get through, you know, starts in AAA. So everybody just take a breath. Tiedemann needs to stay where he is, particularly if he's dealing with elbow problems.
Right. And is there anything on this Wednesday, April 24th, 2024 edition of the Isolation Series that we should cover that we haven't, my friend?
Feels good for today, Spence. So much going on. Looking forward to more playoff hockey tonight. Can't wait to talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Let's go Maple Leafs. Let's see.
Absolutely.
Let's see if we can get up 2-1. I'm going to go glass half full here on the Isolation Series for once and say that the next time we come at you, it is going to be with the Maple Leafs leading the Boston Bruins in the series, but only time will tell. Quick comment from you as we leave, Paul. The WWE World Wrestling Entertainment is known to do a round of cuts, budget cuts, or whatever you want to call it, talent cuts, right after WrestleMania. That happened both last Friday as well as yesterday. And as far as I can tell, there's no real big names like there have been over the last couple of years. But do you anticipate any other names being mentioned in the next few days? Or is this pretty much it? And we have to bitterly say goodbye to both Jinder Mahal and Cameron Grimes, who by all intents and purposes are the biggest names to be let go in this wave of cuts.
Yeah, I mean, there's always personal favorites or you know, everybody has a favorite that, you know, seems to get caught up in these releases. And you never like to see anybody lose their job, but you hope that it's on to bigger and better things and maybe on the road back to promotions like AEW, WWE, wherever you end up. But not a bad time to be a free agent in the world of professional wrestling, as there is a lot of opportunity out there. So I wish the best to everybody that did get released. And yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. It was maybe a little more predictable when we were under the Vince McMahon rule, because he sort of had these It's funny. It was more predictable and less predictable in because McMahon was a maniac and you never know. But then also there was kind of these, you know, post WrestleMania, you know, there was kind of two or three times a year you would see a handful of releases. And now, you know, it's a giant company that's working for shareholders. That's, you know, an entity that also has UFC, and it's just become such a different machine now than it was even last year. And certainly, that, you know, 10 years ago. So it's hard to say. I don't expect anyone else, but I also didn't necessarily expect this round. I thought they had sort of covered that about a week ago, but yeah, it looks like I you know, so it's hard to predict, but I can't imagine any other big names going.
And are you surprised or happy that AEW put their championship belt, their top belt on Swerve, I believe it was, that they put it on this past weekend in St. Louis? We never got around to talking about that on Monday's edition. We know that this company has been around for the better part of 5 years now, and he becomes only the eighth champion so far in that company's history. What do you make of them making him the guy for now? And do you believe he is the right guy to carry that belt?
I think he's great. I think he's the right guy at the right time. I mean, I think if you look at the landscape of AEW, we're looking ahead to another huge all-in pay-per-view in Wembley Stadium in England. So you know, having a top star like Will Ospreay, who, you know, that's home for him, that might be. Swerve might be keeping that belt warm until you look ahead to someone like Ospreay winning it at Wembley. But Swerve's the guy right now. The fans love him. He's got a ton of charisma. He is an excellent professional wrestler. And so, yeah, it's exciting to see. I think right place, right time, right guy. And now we get to see the stories that he can tell at the top of the card.
Absolutely. For Paul Shields, I am Spencer Miller. This has been your Wednesday, April 24th, 2024 edition of the Isolation Series. And as always, we appreciate you watching and or listening wherever it is that you're doing so. And we would like to send a big shout out, as always, to our sponsors, without whom we wouldn't be able to do this as often as we do. And until we come at you with another fantastic episode of the show, take care of yourselves and each other. Bye-bye. And Paul, please tell people all about some more whole grain goodness that is us.
Folks, be sure to check us out on podbean.com by going to theisolationseries.podbean.com. There you'll find the audio-only versions of the podcast, including all of our past amazing interviews. One more time, that's theisolationseries.podbean.com. And hey, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. It's at @thespencermiller and at Pauly Shields, Pauly spelled P-A-W-L-Y. So find us on podbean.com, follow us on Instagram, and don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.
And once again, everybody, thank you for watching and or listening and supporting this thing we like to call the Isolation Series. For Paul Shields, I am Spencer Miller, and we will see you again very, very soon. Bye-bye.